have a question. It's not from our Bible reading, but
sure.
I was looking at Mark the other day, talking about when Jesus was in his hometown, and it said that he was only able to heal a few sick people, and that's all he could do there. It says because of their lack of faith.
Right.
Does it mean that he was unable?
No, it is not an ontological inability. It is not speaking about him not possessing the power.
Okay.
But the reason that strident unbelief would prevent him from doing anything is that when people who had rejected a sign and what the sign signified, but yet continued to ask him for more signs, he would say no. He would do signs when there were people that were open-minded, because signs were designed to prove who he is, in keeping with Deuteronomy chapter 18. But the times that we see Jesus rebuking people for asking for signs, it is on occasions where he has done a sign, they rejected who he is, they come up with explanations saying, well, he's doing this by the power of Satan, by the power of Beelzebul. And then they would say, well, do another sign for us. And so it's not speaking about his inability, but it is that he would only do signs when there were receptive people. And so he was unable to because that was contrary to the purpose for doing signs.
Okay. So it also said that he was astonished at their unbelief, because it says he knew all men's hearts.
Sure.
How what does that astonish really mean?
My sense there is that in his humanity, he would say, this is such persuasive evidence. It is in keeping with everything that was predicted of the Christ. And we have people who claim to love God and love his word that could look at something and reach diametrically the wrong conclusion. In John's Gospel, both in John chapter 5 and in John chapter 10, we have people that became angry at Jesus because they said that he was a man trying to become God. But that's exactly the opposite of what was happening. He's God who became man, and the signs prove that he's God. And so when you had people saying, he's just doing a little magic, and then claiming to be God, he was giving evidence that no man could do. The level of proof was very high, as predicted by Deuteronomy 18, and yet it was being rejected. It's easy to see statements along that line and say, okay, what's going on? But it's a matter of within the argument of each of the books, there's a development. And one of the things also that's puzzling for people in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus many times told people not to tell others about him. Now, that puzzles lots of people. But one of the problems that we see in early chapters in Mark and early chapters in Matthew, well, not so early in Matthew, it's after the Sermon on the Mount, starting in chapter 8, we have statements that Jesus was not able to enter into a town because of his fame. Now, if we think back to signs that he did, after the Sermon on the Mount, when you open up Matthew chapter 8, Jesus healed a leper. No leper had been healed other than Naaman the Syrian since the time of Moses. Remember, Miriam had leprosy. There had not been anyone that had been healed of leprosy other than in the time of Moses and in the time of Elijah. Jesus told the man to go and show himself to the priest. The Old Testament had said that that was the procedure that was supposed to happen. The priests were the ones who had validate whether or not this person truly had had leprosy and whether this person were truly cured. Now the question becomes, why is it that Jesus told the man to go to the priest? One of the accounts, I believe, says as a testimony to them. The priests were supposed to evaluate and say, whoa, this is not something that happens every day. We need to investigate this person and be sure that he's from God. Jesus was seeking to get the national leadership to come and evaluate him. And then the national leadership was in turn supposed to, both the secular leaders and the religious leaders, to tell people, he's passed the test. This is the Messiah. You should believe in him. But what happened instead was the man spread it all over and apparently didn't even go to the priests. And so what happened was you had lots of curiosity seekers, which was fine up to a point, but the procedure that had been set in place in the Old Testament in anticipation of the Messiah coming was that leadership was supposed to evaluate him, reach the conclusion, yes, he is the Messiah, and then they were supposed to assist in proclaiming the message to the nation. And so Jesus was seeking to follow the procedure that was established in the Old Testament, and people weren't cooperating with it. So he told them, don't just spread this. There were procedures. It was supposed to go to the leadership. And so we see the statements prohibiting it, and even his brothers in John chapter 7 say, I go down to Judea because no one does in secret if he hopes to be well known publicly. And no one except Jesus understood the procedure. This is, now, when you think about it, one of the reasons that Jesus worked through his disciples was that they were supposed to be there to help spread the message. And a large part of that was that national leadership had failed to step into the role that they were supposed to. So we have statements that on their surface, what in the world is this doing? But within the larger tapestry, they all fit in.
Yeah, I've always wondered why you would say don't tell anybody. That makes sense.
Yeah, we can see examples there in early chapters after the Sermon on the Mount and Sermon on the Plain that not following that procedure set up problems for him. And so he had to go into town secretly because he would get mobbed, preventing him from making proclamation and doing signs in front of new groups. And you know, just inadvertently, people were interfering with what was supposed to happen. Yes, Dean.
Got one in Corinthians that
okay.
I was like, I know I have a question. I should really start writing these down. So I got into a discussion with Seth, and he was like, well, I met this girl, and I think that you guys would be, I think you would like her. And I was like, well, 50 about Jesus, and I was like, I don't know, man, because Corinthians talks about you being equally yoked with somebody who's a believer as well. And he was like, but it also says that the man of the house, if he's a believer, covers. And I was like, I'll ask John.
Okay. The passage about with regard to children being sanctified through the believing parent, the issue there is that if there is one believing spouse in the house, the likelihood is that the children will be taught about the Lord. The sanctification that it's talking about is in that sense. It is not in the sense that the marriage was supposed to have happened. And the situation of two unbelievers where one of them subsequently, after they've gotten married, becomes a believer is an expected situation, and the believer isn't supposed to use the fact that the other spouse has not yet come to believe as an excuse for a divorce. And so what Paul says in light of that, or to reinforce that, is even though one of the spouses is an unbeliever, there's still the opportunity for the children to be taught by the believing parent, to be taken to church, Sunday school, and all of those types of things. So Paul is saying it's not a situation worthy of getting divorced. That is not for but Paul does not say that a believer should enter into marriage with an unbeliever. So it's a quite different situation.
Okay.
So he's saying it's not so bad that it would warrant divorce, but it's not good enough to warrant marriage.
Yeah. It's like saying marry a homely girl and hope she gets really attractive.
Yes, Rick.
Is Calvinism and total depravity related? Because my last place I was in, they were teaching me about total depravity, and it's exact opposite of what I know about.
Each of the 5 or 6 points of Calvinism do contradict Scripture. With regard to total depravity, the Bible does teach that man is totally alienated from God. But what the Calvinist extends the idea, they take it beyond what the Bible affirms. The Bible affirms total alienation. But the Calvinists, when they use the term total depravity, they also mean total inability. But total inability is a direct contradiction of some key scriptures. Let's take a couple of moments. Let's look at Ephesians chapter 2. Now, this passage that I'm going to go to is one that Calvinists will often go to as well. But the reason that they go there is because they think it says something and it doesn't. Now, I'm going to illustrate. I'm in the process of turning this switch. I am turning it. You notice the light became brighter. And I keep turning it, and it finally goes off. Now I'll turn it again. I'm turning it right now. But eventually the light comes on. When the spring causes the circuit size completion. Now, does the light come on before I turn the switch? The light comes on after I turn the switch. Now, I'm going to make a statement the light came on through turning the switch. When I say through, what follows the word through has to precede the thing that it is a means for. The light came on through turning the switch. Through happens first, light came on, right? Or with my ignition, the car started through me turning the switch. Through happens first. Now let's look here at Ephesians 2. In the Greek, what we have is one sentence that goes all the way from verse 1 through the end of verse 7. In English, because our grammar is different than Greek, they normally break the sentence at verse 3. So end of verse 3, all of our English translations have a period. Now, how many are looking at a New King James? Okay, if you're not, if you can look on with someone that does. So those who have a New King James, hold your hand up. And so those of you who don't, get next to someone who has a New King James. Okay. When you're looking in chapter 2, verse 1, do you see any words in italics?
He made a lie.
Now, the reason that they have put that in italics is you can't find those words in the Greek of verse 1. But now drop down to verse 5. Now, actually, at verse 4, we have God as the subject. But God, then drop down into the middle of verse 5, made us alive together. Since they put a period in verse 3, the translators have chosen to let us know that made alive is part of this sentence. So they put it in verse 1, in order to say, it really is in this sentence. It's in italics because in verse 1, we don't have the verb made alive. But it does show up in the sentence in verse 5. Okay, now you can return to your seats. I just wanted you to see that because if you're looking at a translation other than the New King James, when I talk about this, you'd say, well, I don't see those words. Now, let's look at what the problem is that Paul describes for people. Notice in verse 1, he says that you were dead in trespasses. Now look at the beginning of verse 5, even when we were dead in trespasses. Now, we have a problem for people, and the problem is they were dead. Now, if someone's dead and you want to solve their problem, what do you have to do to them? Make them alive. And so he said in verse 1, you were dead. And then he reminds us here by adding those words, God made you who were dead alive. And then in verse 5, it says, we were dead. And the Greek right there in verse 5 says, God made us alive. So the problem that people have is that they were dead. Now the Calvinist says, if someone's buried in a tomb and they're dead, they're a corpse, that person can't do anything. And they'll say, have you ever seen a corpse get up and walk? And we say, no. And so the word dead, they interpret as unable to do anything. That's their understanding of the word dead. But let's look a little closer. In verse 5, you'll notice that we have some words that are in parentheses, or you might have M dashes, long, long, long hyphens. You either have parentheses or you have long hyphens within verse 5. by grace you have been saved. Now, when you have a parenthesis, you have to ask, why is there a parenthesis? One of the most common reasons that we would have a parenthesis is that the words that are in a parenthesis are saying in a different way what was just said. Now, what was said in verse 5 right before that? He made alive. Who is it that he made alive? People who were dead. Now, let me ask a very simple question. If you said that you saved someone who was dead, but the person still remained dead, would it make sense to say that that person was saved? How do you save a dead man if you don't make him alive? When he says you were saved, what he means here is that's another way of saying you were made alive. Now, let's drop down to verse 8. Paul wants to reinforce what he said in the parenthesis in verse 5, where he said, by grace you have been saved. And so what he says in verse 8 is, for by grace you have been saved. But now he adds something. Through faith. Now, which happened first? Being made alive or believing? And why would we say believing has to happen first? We have the word through. The light came on through.
You've been doing this for a while.
So now what that means is Paul is saying people believe while they're dead. Now, if Paul is saying that people believe while they're dead, Paul doesn't mean by dead unable to do anything. Because if he meant that they were a corpse, unable to believe, Paul has just said they believed while they were dead. Because they believed first, then they were made alive. Now, it's a split second, just like when I turn the switch, there's just a split, I mean, really infinitesimally small length of time between the completion of the circuit and when you can see the light. But people believe while they're dead. Now, the Reformed, the Calvinist, says that God made people alive and then they believed. That's backwards. That's backwards. That's not what Paul's saying. So now what we want to do is we want to find out if in the book of Ephesians, we're not going to go somewhere else, we're going to go in Ephesians. We want to find out if in the book of Ephesians, Paul tells us what dead means. And what he's going to say is not that it means unable to do anything. He has a different meaning. So let's go to Ephesians chapter 4. Verse 17, this I say therefore and testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk. Now, if you don't have a New King James, you don't have the words the rest up. I believe they belong there. But that's not where we're going to focus. The way that Gentile unbelievers walk is they have a futility of mind. They're going in circles, making no forward progress. He's saying there's a futility about their mindset. But now the question is, why do Gentile unbelievers have a futile mindset? Why is it that they're going nowhere fast? Verse 18, it is because of having their understanding darkened. It's like turning off the light switch. Why is it that they're like in a dark room, not able to see anything? Well, then that comes in the next part. Because of being alienated from the life of God. Alienation. Separation. Dead is talking about they're alienated from God and the life that God gives. Dead is not talking about inability. If dead were talking about inability, then why does Paul say that people believe while they're dead and then they're made alive? The Calvinist has the wrong definition for dead. And by ignoring that people believe while they're dead and then they're made alive, the Calvinist ends up turning the whole passage upside down. Dean.
How many times have you gone through this?
Quite a few.
Quite a few. And we have another passage that we'll go to. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I recently wrote on them, and so I'm hoping that a book that's supposed to be published next month will have my two essays, one about Ephesians 2 and the other one about 2 Corinthians 4. Okay, in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 3, Paul says, "But even if our gospel is veiled," okay, he talked in the previous chapter about when people would read the Old Testament, they'd have a hard time seeing Jesus because it was like a veil was put over their face. He's later on going to use the term blind, that Satan blinds the minds of the unbeliever. But he's just defined for us the way that what he means by blinding. It is blinding by means of a veil that prevents light from shining through. So now let's look at this. He says, "But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the god of this age," that's Satan, "has blinded, who do not believe, lest." Now you may have a different rendering besides the word lest. Let me hear some of the other translations at that point. Says, "Lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them." What do you have that's in the place of lest?
So they cannot.
So that they cannot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Preventing.
Each of these is a purpose statement. A purpose statement would be like, I open my Bible for the purpose of reading it. It's kind of hard to read it like this. I can quote passages I already know, but I can't read it unless I open it. So, the word lest, or so they cannot, or preventing, all mean that Satan is doing something in order that something else will not happen. So, however your translation is worded, that's what it means. It's Satan does this to prevent something from happening afterwards. Now, what is it that he wants to prevent? He wants to prevent the message from penetrating the mind. Lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. And so, that word lest is a really important word, so that something wouldn't happen. Why is it important? It's saying that if Satan were not there trying to confuse people, everyone would believe. That doesn't sound like what the Calvinists say. The Calvinists say that the message is impossible for unbelievers to understand because unbelievers are spiritually incapable of believing. Satan is not a Calvinist. Satan is there trying to prevent people from believing because he knows that if he doesn't do that, they will believe. How does God overcome the problem? He doesn't overcome the problem by making them believe. Verse 6 tells us what he does. In verse 6 it says, "For it is God who commanded light to shine out of darkness." Think back to Genesis 1. "For it is God who commanded light to shine out of darkness, who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." Now, this is not a rheostat, but you know how rheostats work, where it gradually gets brighter? Here we have the unbeliever. The unbeliever is in darkness, and his veil is enough that he doesn't see light now. Maybe he doesn't see light now, but maybe he sees a little flicker of light. God turns up the light. If people can respond to the light, it says that God isn't the Calvinist. Because the Calvinist says, no matter how bright it is, people cannot respond to it. It's like they don't have eyeballs. Whereas what Paul is saying is, it can be very hard for the light to penetrate, but God can turn up the brightness enough with the truth of his word that the truth can shine through, and a person says, "Oh, I get it now. God is not a Calvinist."
But John, put this in the category of, I don't want to be too harsh, but doctrine of demons, like, what are doctrine of demons, right? I mean, in your estimation, is it like really false teaching, or is it, does it even fit gray areas where...
It definitely fits gray areas.
Okay.
What I would say is we have a system of truth that we introduce a little error into. Doctrines of demons are going to be where you're going to have systems of falsehood that have just enough truth to make them seem to fit the data.
Okay.
And so when people become confused on the gift of everlasting life, it's a very, very, very serious thing. And it isn't that the ones who are teaching incorrectly on this, that every word out of their mouth is a bad word, but some of the strategic points that need to be clear get muddied. And so, yes, there are multitudes of areas of gray, but when it's enough to prevent a person from seeing the message that gives life.
And I'm not saying that people even understand what they're doing necessarily, right?
Absolutely.
And that's what makes it kind of, like more of a demonic realm, because it's it's being perpetrated as truth, and it's...
Right.
Yeah, it's causing...
When you ask people, which is better? Faith alone or faith plus works? Almost everyone will say, well, if you add, it must be better. But the problem is there are situations where adding is really subtracting. Because what happens is when you add works to grace, grace ceases to be grace. And the illustration is used many times in Scripture. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. Because it doesn't... let's put it this way. On the phone, I was talking with a friend of mine today, and I said, as we were talking about a related issue, I said, there are many theologians who think that... they're in the business of taking target practice with either a shotgun, a hand grenade, or they're playing horseshoes. In each of those, close is good enough. But when a person misses the bullseye on grace by a little bit, the whole message has been compromised. You know, it's like... if there were a BB hole right in the very corner of one of those windows, we wouldn't say, well, most of the window is just fine. What are you worried about that little BB hole for? It doesn't take much to compromise something that requires integrity of the whole. Okay, very good. I figured there might be a few questions underlying if I gave it a little time to simmer. Very good. Okay, let's proceed. We have a passage I think we'll be able to move along fairly well. This is in the epilogue to the book. We have looked for a number of weeks at the judges, and here they are in order. Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Tola, Jair, Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, Abdon, and Samson. And you remember that we had approximately a 300-year slot that the book of Judges must fit in between the book of Joshua and 1 Samuel. And we saw that because there are overlaps between some of the judges, that is, one judge is here and the next one starts after the first one's completely done, that there's some overlap between them. This all fits within a 300-year period of time. The judges that we've been looking at, that I have listed here, are all in sequence, although some of them have overlap between them. But the passage that we're going to look at tonight, we're going to jump back to the very beginning of the book of, or the very beginning of the time period of the Judges. We're going to jump back about 250 years. And so we've been working our way through, and as we've gotten further and further in the book, we've gotten to a later and later and later date. The book of Judges is arranged with the main body of the book talking about Israel under each of those judges. But now in the epilogue to the book, what the author wants to say is, well, what was Israel like just in general? Not what was it like under this judge, what was it like under that judge, but to give us a flavor for what the nation was like. So we've looked at, it goes through a pattern of sin, servitude, they pray, they're delivered, and then there's a period of silence or rest. Now what we're going to do is get a picture of what Israel was like in general. Not looking in relation to any of the judges. And so the first episode that we're going to have is going to take us back to the beginning of the time of the judges. And so the interesting thing is, you remember, Samson was from the tribe of Dan. And he lived in the territory of Dan. And so Samson of the tribe of Dan was born about 1123 BC. He died no later than 1084 BC at approximately the age 39. He died in the prime of his life. He died early. In Judges 17 and 18 that we're going to look at tonight, it's also going to be that same tribe of Dan that's going to be the focus. But the date for these chapters is around 1399 BC. It's going to be right at the end of the time of Joshua, right at the beginning of the time. So we're going to be looking at an event that's about 276 years before Samson was born. So about 300 years before he started really functioning. We're looking at the same tribe that he was in, Dan. Now, let's look at it another way. Samson's parents were Danites, that's what you call people from the tribe of Dan, who stayed in the original tribal allotment. I'll show you a map in a moment. God had given an area, and he said, this is where Dan is supposed to live. This is their territory. And Samson was right at the end of the time of the judges. It's not long afterwards, and Samuel comes on the scene in the book of 1 Samuel. Well, Judges 17 and 18 that we're going to be looking at is talking about Danites who didn't stay in the area of Dan, but approximately 300 years before the time of Samson, they moved somewhere else.
So is that the key why this place is these two chapters?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so, since we're not looking at individual judges, we have to look for clues in the passage as to when this happened. And we're going to get a very interesting clue. Now, the area of Dan, when we flew into Israel, we flew into Lod, Ben-Gurion Airport. That's in the tribal area of Dan. So that's a small tribal area. But it is a major pathway. Lots of commerce. It's one of the easier places to cross the mountain ranges as you're in central or southern Israel. But we're going to have this group of people who are part of the tribe of Dan that are going to move way up north, and they're going to conquer a place and rename it Dan. And so when we were in Israel, we were in Tel Dan. So when we flew into Israel, we flew into the tribal area of Dan. And then after we had been there several days, we went to the town called Dan. And this passage is going to give us the history of how all of that came about. And so I need to turn back to Judges chapter 17. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, how many different kind of, like, you know, there's Canaanites and Perizzites and, you know, how many different is there in the Bible, different tribes and stuff?
There are a lot of them, but it's about 13 or 14 that were in the immediate vicinity of Israel. And so previous lessons, I've given the seven out of the passage in Deuteronomy and then some of the others that were surrounding. But there were quite a number of them that they were dealing with on a daily basis. Okay, Judges chapter 17. I'm talking here a little bit about chronology. I'm going to wait until late in the chapter because the evidence for the date of these events is going to come at the end of our passage. But this is an epilogue, and as a result, he's not staying on the same chronological scheme. He could have put this at the beginning of the book, but he chose to put it at the end, even though it's an event that happened very, very early. We're going to have a man by the name of Micah, and we're going to look at him with a major focus on just him in verses 1 through 13. And he's definitely an interesting character, but let's give a little bit of background here before we look at the passage. This is an area within the tribe of Ephraim, and so it's a place called the Ascent of Ephraim. If you look way off in the distance, you can see the Jordan River. So this is quite hilly, and you can see that the road coming up here is a very steep one from the valley. And so this is giving an idea that the terrain of the tribe of Ephraim is a rather hilly region. Now, this man that we're going to be introduced has the name Micah. Now, Micah, although it's a really short word, has three parts to it. Me, means who. Greek doesn't, I mean, Hebrew doesn't normally put the verb to be in there, so we add the word is, and the k means like, and ah is standing for Yahweh. So his name means who is like Yahweh. So his father, and we'll learn a little bit about his father, obviously had very high hopes for this man, but Micah is an idolater. It's not the same Micah that's the book of Micah in the latter part of the Old Testament. This is a completely different person. Micah was not an uncommon name. So let's start here in 17:1. Now there was a certain man from the mountains of Ephraim, so you can see why I showed you the terrain, whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me, I took it. Wow, this is a really upstanding young citizen we've got here. He's stolen from his mother, and then when his mother puts a curse, he says, uh-oh, I better fess up, so she'll undo the curse. And so his mother undid the curse. She said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my son. So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I have wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now therefore, I will return it to you. Now this is what types of images on the right-hand side have been found in Israel. These are called teraphim. And so these are little idols, usually with a sexual connotation on them. And so does she sound like a very knowledgeable worshiper of the Lord here? No. Not at all. And so in verse 4, thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver, gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. Verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine. There weren't supposed to be private shrines. The one shrine was where the tabernacle was, and that was in a town along, well, not in this immediate vicinity, and that was in Shiloh. But he's got his own private shrine that he's built where he goes and worships his little silver images that his mother gave to a silversmith to make. And you say, if a man can make a god, that's not much of a god, is it? And so none of these people here sound like they're very knowledgeable about the things of the Lord. So he had a shrine and made an ephod. And so on the left, we have the ephod, the garment, worn by a high priest. And so we don't know what his ephod looked like, but it's probably pretty fancy. He thinks of himself as his own priest. But what tribe was he from? Not this man. He's from Ephraim, back in verse 1. Now there was a certain man from the mountains of Ephraim. We're going to find Dan is going to enter into this, but this man is not from Dan. He's from Ephraim. And so he's acting as his own priest. So when you start looking at this, he's got his own shrine, whereas there was only one shrine, and it wasn't at his house that was legitimate. He's made his own high priest garment, and he's made himself into a priest, and he's got his own gods that his mother paid for some man to make. Yes, John?
Awesome.
Oh, okay. So, anyway, as we see, this guy has no concept of what's up and what's down. And then he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. Now, he's operating in total ignorance. This would definitely be doctrine of demons. I mean, this guy is running off in his own direction. He's just rejected everything that's been explained in the Old Testament. But we're going to find out this man was not unusual. Look at verse 6. This statement is repeated a number of times in the book of Judges, from now on through the end of the book. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what is right in his own eyes. Well, if it was right in their own eyes, it wasn't right in God's eyes. God had given them very clear indication of how they were supposed to conduct themselves, and the nation is in absolute rebellion. Now, if the whole nation is like this, you know, you'd think that God would say, I'm done with them. But God had made promises that even though Israel was going to depart so far from him, he would never forget the promise that he had made to them. God remained faithful, and when the people would pray to him, oh, it's become really awful under these foreign oppressors, God would raise up judges, and God raised up a whole series of judges. So we've been told earlier in the book many times, Israel went into sin. We're starting to get a picture of what Israel was like when Israel went into sin. They've got a man that's created his own shrine, his own gods, his own priesthood, his own ephod. He has no use for what God has to say at all. They're using the name Yahweh. It shows up a number of times in this passage, but they are far, far, far away from the Lord. In verses 7 through 13, he figures, well, if I get a Levite to be my priest, that will be even better than having my son as a priest. He said, priests, I guess, are supposed to come from the tribe of Levi. So we might think, well, he's getting a little better. Not so fast. Verses 7 through 13. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah. I'll show you a picture of Bethlehem at night. And
that's cool.
So there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah. It's going to be important later. He's called a young man. That's going to be important for dating things. He's from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite and was staying there. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. Then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. As he journeyed, and Micah said to him, where do you come from? So he said, I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am on my way to find a place to stay. Remember, Levites could go anywhere through the country, and they had their own towns, their Levitical cities, but they could go anywhere that they wanted to. Other tribes, they had their specific areas where they were expected to live. So Micah said to him, dwell with me, and be a father and a priest to me. And I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year. Now, he said, this is a pretty good sum. So the 1,100 shekels, that was a lot of money. So he said, I'll give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance. So the Levite went in. Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah consecrated the priest. He's acting like a high priest. He consecrated him. And the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord, and the word there is Yahweh, will be good to me since I have a Levite as a priest. Now, obviously, Micah has a lot of money. He might have stolen some other money from his mother, but he's got a lot of money. He can spend, he can do what he wants to. Now, remember, this is the tribe of Dan, and then on the right-hand side, I'm showing a map, and you can see Jebus, and below that you can see Hebron. Well, in between Jebus, which is now called Jerusalem, and Hebron is Bethlehem. But he wanted to go up into the mountains of Ephraim. So he's traveled a little bit north along the spine of this mountain ridge. And so he's, he figures he's got a pretty good deal here with Micah. He's making some money, has a place to stay, and he can be his priest. I don't think this Levite knows very much about the Lord either. Would you think?
No.
Basically, the Micah said, well, I've got a good luck charm. I've got a Levite. And so the Lord will bless me even more. Now we start chapter 18. And we're going to here look at the Danite migration. So this is going to be the circumstances where the tribe of Dan decides to move to another place that's outside of their area. Verse 1 is going to give us a little bit of a clue as to the timing of this, but the real punchline will come later in the chapter. Here in verse 1, it's talking about the Danites had failed to take their inheritance. The inheritance was given by no later than 1399 BC, as we saw when we went through the book of Joshua. So this has to be at least a little bit before the distribution. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And since there's no king, people did whatever they wanted. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. So it's before Joshua has said, okay, this is where you will be. This is your land. And so they say, we're in a rush. We want to take land. We'll get it right now. We aren't going to wait for God to tell us where we're supposed to be. This is very early. It's before 1399. It's before the distribution. The distributions all happened during a seven-year period of time between 1406 and 1399. Or actually, the conquest was between those years, and 1399 was the year of the inheritance being split up under Joshua. So, that's showing here the area of Dan. Let me bring up the next. Oh no, actually, that'll be fine there. So in 18:2 through 6, the Danites, five Danites, meet Micah's Levite in Ephraim. So they're out scouting for some land that they can steal. I mean, that's basically what's going on. And so in verses 2 through 6, they're looking. So the children of Dan sent five men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtaol. About 300 years later, that's where Samson was born. Okay, let's look at Eshtaol. Here's it within the valley of the Sorek, spread out, and so on and so forth. And they're looking for some place. So it says that they went out from Zorah and Eshtaol. These are men of valor. That's another way of saying these are warriors. This is a military scouting expedition. They're trying to figure out, are there some people that are weak enough that we can take their land from them? So they said to them, to these five men, go search the land. So they went to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. While they were at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. He may have a Judean accent. They may have recognized, okay, he sounds like someone that would be in our area. Let's back up here. Notice that we have the tribal area on the map on the left of, well, either way. You notice that Dan neighbors against Judah. People in Judah would have a similar accent. And so they're recognizing this sounds like someone from our area. He doesn't sound like someone from Ephraim. We ran into the, remember the Shibboleth passage? Mm-hmm. People in Ephraim had a different pronunciation. So they're saying, he sounds like one of our people. We can trust him. So it says that they recognize his voice. I would say probably they recognize his the accent of his voice. They turned aside and said to him, who brought you here? We know you're not from this place, so how did you end up here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here? And you notice they're in the process of looking to be able to take some land for themselves, so they're looking for any weakness they can expose. So he said to them, thus and so Micah did for me. He hired me and I have become his priest. So they said to him, please inquire of God so we may know whether the journey on which we will go will be prosperous. And the priest said to them, go in peace. The presence of the Lord be with you on your way. So they're saying, wow, God's going to bless us. But we have to say, how much did this Levite know? He's not reflecting what God's thinking is. He's going off in his own direction. Well, in verses 7 through 10, the five men went to Laish. Now, Laish soon became known as Dan or Tel Dan. That's up north, way up north. So the five men departed and went to Laish. They saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the manner of the Sidonians. And in order to make this clear, I'll point at the map and that can help a little bit. Tyre is here. Sidon is a little bit off the top of the map, and it's also along the Mediterranean. Dan is way over here, and this is an area that was controlled by Sidon. But there are a lot of mountains in between Sidon and Laish that later became known as Dan. So they say it will be very hard for them to bring in reinforcements all the way from Sidon to protect this place. So they say, let's figure out if we can take it. And that's exactly what they're thinking. So again in verse 7. So the five men departed and went to Laish. They saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. They were far from the Sidonians and had no ties with anyone. They say, no alliances. We don't have to worry about anyone coming to their rescue. So they said, then the spies came back to their brethren at Zorah and Eshtaol, and their brethren said to them, what is your report? So they said, arise, let us go against them, for we have seen the land, and indeed it is very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go and enter to possess the land. When you go, you will come to a secure people and a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. They're saying, wow, this is a place we can conquer and no one will come to their rescue. And that Levite said, God will bless you. So in verses 11 through 28a, we have 600 Danite warriors, and they wage a campaign against Laish. In verses 11 through 13, they first stop at a place called Kiriath Yearim. What that means is city of forests. And so, let's talk a little bit here about the map, because I'm going to be showing you after a bit a number of pictures of Tel Dan to give you kind of an idea of this place they will end up taking. When we went to Tel Dan, we were at the lower left corner at the parking lot. That's where our bus parked. And then we went around this tell going counterclockwise. So we first went to what I have abbreviated IG, the Israeli gate. Then we saw the Canaanite gate. Then we went to the high place. Then we went past the spring and followed the stream. Now, I wish that I had noticed when we were there that we were very close to a stretch of Roman road that I could have walked to. Oh, well. But let's look at Tel Dan. This is, as we've said, way north in Israel. When you read in the Bible, it will often say, clear from Dan to Beersheba. You run into that statement. Dan was way up north. Beersheba was way down south. So it was a way of saying the whole land. So Dan is way up north, and we could look into Syria and into Lebanon from there. Remember, we came up on the Israeli walls. This would date back to the time here of the book of Judges. And so we were down below that wall. I'll show you an aerial view of Tel Dan. And so you can see those were substantial walls, and they were undoubtedly taller than they are even now in biblical times. Then we come to the Israeli city gate. So you round the corner and you've got a city gate. And we'll talk a little bit about how gates are set up, and where you see the white circle and the little inset, that's showing where we are in relation to Tel Dan. North is at the top. So we're on the southern edge near the southeastern corner. The way that a gate would be set up, they would have several gates, and they would allow people to come in one gate, but the other gate would be closed, and so on and so forth, so that they could keep the place secure and not have people come in. And they were set up to be able to shoot arrows and do anything if an invader happened to get inside the first gate. Gates are very important places. There's something really important about this gate. This is showing a plan for the gate, and I recognize the print may be a little bit small, but this is the outer gate. And then you have an inner gate in here. But as you're looking at the outer gate, right in here, that was used or recycled as building material, is an amazing stele. Now, the reason it's broken is because they used it as building material. But this is talking about an invasion or a campaign waged by Syria against the House of David. House of David is the dynasty of David. There have been many people for many, 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 many centuries, ever since the 1700s, that have tried to say that, oh, there was never a person by the name of David, and that that was an invention that happened well after Old Testament times would have been over with. Well, then, why is it that we have a foreign power talking about the house, the ruling dynasty of David? And so, here at Tel Dan, this stele was discovered that is just really fantastic. So it's right here in this Israeli gate. They ended up having to rebuild walls at various times, and that was a piece that they decided to use as construction material. Now we go to the Canaanite gate. And I've given an inset picture showing we've got an archway. This is the oldest archway that anyone has discovered in the entire world. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was in junior high school and high school, I was told that the Greeks invented the arch, and they would have dated it long after this. But this goes back to the time of the patriarchs. And it is not impossible that Abraham, when he rescued Lot, really good possibility, since it mentions that he went to this town, that he actually went through this very gate. And so that's on the extreme southeastern corner. They put a building over it to protect it from degrading by weather. Now there's a high place here and a sacrificial altar. What we're looking at here is the sacrificial altar. What's been added here to give people an idea was that they've put a metal framework to show what the altar might have been like.
They say they take hold of the horns and
yes.
those ends.
Right, and the purpose for those horns was to be able to tie the sacrifice in place. And so, now, one of the things that you notice here is these are hewn stones.
What, sorry?
Hewn, they're cut. They're cut into blocks. And the Old Testament, God said he wanted no altars that would be built with cut stones. This was built by Jeroboam, so this is looking at, say, soon after 931 BC, after the nation has split into two parts, and we're told, let's see, I'll give you the passage, in 1 Kings 12, verses 25 through 33, it mentions Jeroboam building an altar and putting up idols here. So the altar is on the left-hand side of the dotted yellow line, and on the right side is a high place. Now, people tend to think of high places as really high, but it was high enough that someone could seem like they were important as they were addressing a group of people. And so when you see high place, it's a different impression than we, you know, we're thinking something way, 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 way tall. Whereas this is a high place on the right-hand side, and God was against those. Let's look at an aerial view. So, I mean, you're seeing some things here that we weren't able to see. This is looking at the high place and the altar at Tel Dan as an aerial view. And so you know, it's really neat to be able to see it in even more detail from different perspectives than what we saw. This is the place that they've said, we can take it. And you notice there was that Canaanite gate. It's showing that was an important place even back in the time of Abraham, which is about the time that that arch dates back to. Oldest arch that anyone has discovered in the whole world. So we've got these Danites that have come up here. I've 600 warriors, and where they're going to stop first is at Kiriath Yearim, which means city of forests. Now, I put the dotted line there. There's a freeway right there. We were on it, but we were on it at night. That was as we were driving from Jerusalem to get to the airport to come home. I would have loved to have seen this area during the daytime, and it was a disappointment that we weren't able to see any of this area. And so what I've circled here on the map is Jebus, which would be Jerusalem, and then Kiriath Yearim, and then to the northwest is Lod, and that's where the airport is. So we were heading basically in that direction. We were going, but these men that we're going to look at here in this verse were going the other way. They were heading towards the Jerusalem area so that they could go north. So let's take a look at verses 11 through 13, their arrival at Kiriath Yearim. And 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there, from Zorah and Eshtaol, armed with weapons of war. Then they went up and encamped at Kiriath Yearim in Judah. Therefore they called that place Mahane Dan, which is another way of saying the encampment of Dan. And therefore they call that place Mahane Dan to this day. There it is, west of Kiriath Yearim. And they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. So they've come, they've said, okay, this was a great place, they were friendly, and he said the Lord would bless you, and so on and so forth. So in verse 14, the five Danites end up telling the 600 Danites about Micah and the Levite. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, the 600, "Do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, the household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now therefore, do you consider what you should do." So in verses 15 through 21, the 600 take Micah's idols and persuade the Levite to join them. So here we go. Verse 15. So they turned aside and came to the house of the young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. The 600 men armed with their weapons of war, who were the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. The priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. When these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" So they said to him, "Be quiet, put your hand over your mouth, and come with us, be a father and a priest to us. It is better for you to be a priest to the household. Is it better for you to be the priest to the household of one man, or that you should be the priest to a tribe and a family in Israel?" So the priest's heart was glad. He said, "Well, I'm going to get rich." He took the ephod, the household idols, the carved image, and took his place among the people. Then they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and their goods in front of them. Nice bunch of guys. Well, in verses 22 through 26, Micah tries to reclaim his idols and his priest, but leaves when threatened. Verses 22 through 26. When they were a good way away from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. And they called out to the children of Dan. So they turned around and said to Micah, "What ails you that you have gathered such a company?" So he said, "You have taken away my gods, which I have made, and the priest, and you have gone away. Now, what more do I have? How can you say to me, 'What ails you?'" And the children of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry men fall upon you, and you lose your life with the lives of your household." Then the children of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. No one's paying attention to the Lord. Micah isn't. The Levite isn't. The five warriors that went to scout, the 600 men and all their children, and nobody's paying attention to the Lord. It's who's strongest. Who can take away from those that can't defend themselves? And that's basically the picture we've got. It's telling us, during the time of the judges, the nation was just absolutely awful. Doesn't that point out that when God said he would not abandon Israel, no matter how bad Israel got, we're going to get more glimpses in the remaining chapters of just how bad Israel was when everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So now we're going to come to the conquest of Laish. And let's see, actually we'll go two slides. Okay. Sorry about that slide. That one was one I meant to delete. So we'll leave it there for now.
What's that say?
We'll talk about that on the next slide. I was making this slide and I didn't end up deleting that one. In verses 27 through 28a, we're going to see the conquest of Laish. So they took the things Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and went to Laish, to a people quiet and secure. They struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. There was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon, and they had no ties with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehov, which means an expansive house. So they've taken the city. It didn't have anyone to come to their rescue, and they conquered it. They burned it. It's now theirs. So the Danites adopt Micah's idolatry in opposition to the sanctuary at Shiloh. Verses 28b through 31. So they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. They called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. Then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh. Do any of your Bibles have a note by Manasseh?
This Bible says son of Gershom, son of Moses.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you have notes saying that it may refer to Moses. I'm going to teach you a little Hebrew. What we have here, now Hebrew is read from right to left. So the text of actual manuscripts has the letter M, and then the letter N is raised. Now what they're saying when it's raised is, we don't know if it really belongs here. We think it goes here, but we're not going to take a dogmatic stand. M, N, S, or SH. If it didn't have a dot, you couldn't tell if it was an S or an SH. The dot at the top. And then an H. So if we look at the consonants, if you don't have the N in there that I put in, M, N, S, H, H, they didn't put vowels in. Vowels were added much, much, much later. If you don't have the N, it's the word Moshe. And this is what it looks like when you add the vowels. And if you put the N in there, then what we have is Manasseh. what seems to have happened was the text read Moses, Moshe. But some scribes said, oh, a descendant of Moses couldn't do this. And so they dropped an N in there. But when they added it, one of the things that they were careful to do if they added was to make it so that people could tell that they added it by raising it. Say, we're not going to put this letter the way it would normally be as a signal that maybe it doesn't belong there. We think it has to be in there to correct it saying Moses, but they weren't sure. So they put it raised. Now the Greek and the Latin both have taken it as Moses. And so some translations will say Moses, most of them say Manasseh. But let's think about it. What tribe was Moses from? He was from the tribe of Levi. And Moses had a son named Gershom. And that son was born rather late in Moses' life. But Manasseh was his own tribe, not Levite, and would have been from up north. But we've got a Levite who's down in the south. So I've given you a mnemonic before. Mabel grinds horseradish. My wife can attest that my mother, Mabel, used to grind horseradish. So Mabel grinds, but the word grinds is spelled in a very funny way. It's spelled as though it were written in Dutch. G-R-I-J-N-D-S-Z. From that, you can remember all the tribes of Israel. Manasseh, and I've underlined it because the question is this from Manasseh? Asher, Benjamin, Ephraim, Levi, Gad, Reuben, Issachar, Judah, Naphtali, Dan, Simeon, Zebulun. So if you can remember the odd way of spelling Mabel grinds, you can remember the names of all the tribes of Israel. And so what this would be, since I believe that the text should read Moses, let's look again at verse 31. Or verse 30. Jonathan, that's the name of the Levite, who's called a young man. And remember I said that was going to be important. He's a young man in this passage. The son of Gershom, the son of Moses. This would be Moses' grandson. Now when you think about it, was Moses ever the high priest?
No.
No. He was of the tribe of Levi, but it was only the descendants of Aaron, Moses' brother, that were allowed to be priests. We've never been told that this man was of the tribe of Aaron, I mean the branch, the clan of Aaron, and he's made himself into a priest. Levites, in general, were not supposed, only those who were descended from Aaron. And so, all sorts of things are going wrong in this passage. But let's see how this would work out. Moses, we can date, as we work through the biblical evidence, he was born in 1526 B.C. His son Gershom was born about 1450 B.C., I've got books that set up all the evidence. But it's important. That is a date after 1464. We'll explain why that's important. The Exodus was in 1446 B.C. Kadesh Barnea, where the 10 spies gave the bad report. They said, we can't take the land. And two, Joshua and Caleb said, we can take this good land because God is giving it. You remember, as a result of Kadesh Barnea, God did not allow anyone except for Joshua and Caleb, who was over the year of age 20, to enter into the land. 1464 is the cutoff date, because that's 20 years before Kadesh Barnea. As we work through the evidence, Gershom would have been born after that cutoff. He would have been less than 20 years old at Kadesh Barnea. And that's only 49 years before the end of the conquest. So he can have a son who would be called a young man. This requires this passage to be at the beginning of the time of the judges. Also, it needs to be at the beginning of the time of the judges because this passage happened before Dan was given his allotment by Joshua. Even before God told Joshua, tell them this is your land, they said, we've got to go and steal some land. And they went around looking for someone that was weak that they could steal the land from.
So that took two generations for them to forget.
Yes. So, I mean, it really gives an idea of how bad things were in Israel during the time of the judges. A descendant of Moses, only two generations.
That's amazing.
John, it's amazing. I can read those two chapters and I sort of get it. But when you go through the history that we're talking about, tell Dan, we're not talking about the tribe of Dan, you know, we're talking about Moses' grandson as the young Levite priest. I mean, it's so much richer when we understand everything you explained tonight. It's just, thank you for bringing these chapters to life. It's really...
It's fun to study it. I mean, I have as much fun studying it. There are a lot of the features I'm talking about that I knew before I started studying this for this, but then, you know, it's like some details come in and you say, oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah, the chronology I would never even consider. I mean, I just read it and assume it's chronological.
Right. I have some excellent books on chronology. And it just, if we understand the chronology of events, a lot of things become clearer. And the geography, knowing how the pieces fit together, there just are a lot of details that it's...
The subplots with the, you know, the Danites, you know, kind of jumping the gun and with the tribe of Ephraim, would they have a problem with the Danite city in their territory?
Well, it's actually in the area that they took was actually in East Manasseh.
Okay. So would that's not a problem for the tribe of Manasseh?
Well, Manasseh hadn't yet taken anything in that area, and Manasseh ended up saying, okay, by the time they ended up taking things, that was already a little territory of Dan within their territory.
Yeah.
John, wasn't it you that told me that the Israelites, on taking land that was promised to them by God, they got a little lazy and content with what they had?
That's the general
kind of case of these guys. They were a little overambitious.
Oh, sure.
Well, they were two generations.
Yep. Rick.
All I know is I'm never going to complain about how dangerous
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's just absolutely wild.
Everybody killing everybody back there.
Yeah.
The whole towns and families, you know.
So, John, was this specific incident ever judged as a specific incident? I mean, I know that the northern tribes were taken, you know, by Syria and things, but was that ever judged, you know, this Levitical faux pas ever judged?
I don't know of any direct retribution that's referring to this, but the northern tribes got away from the Lord real fast, and when Jeroboam came in, it's not surprising that this is a place that he would build that altar with cut stones and put in pagan idols and so on and so forth.
Korah, I mean, that was judged so severely.
Right.
So, I mean, it seems odd that wasn't. Well, guys didn't come against the high priestly line.
I wouldn't be able to say that it wasn't judged, but it isn't recorded.
Okay.
Little vignettes are given to us, and there's so much more going on. The author of the book is saying, this is what Israel was like. And, you know, it really gives context when you see the people screaming at Samuel and they say, we need a king. As they're saying, everyone's in a free-for-all. And we need a king. Whereas if they had accepted God as their king, things would have been resolved. Now, I've shown Shiloh. You'll notice the star that's further south. Dan is way up north. The sanctuary where they were supposed to be worshiping was down in the tribal region of Ephraim, but it was not at Micah's house. And so when Micah has his own Levite and his own priesthood and his own ephod and his own household idols, he didn't have to go very far to the place where he was supposed to be worshiping. He was in Ephraim. And Shiloh is in Ephraim. And so this is showing what the area of excavation at Shiloh.